Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. And thanks for inviting me. I am really, really happy to be here in this cathedral of theoretical physics. It's an amazing place. So thanks, Chung, for getting me here. I was asked to not talk about quantum Hall effect, which I guess Sentil probably would hear it for the final fourth or fifth time if I did. So you'll have to suffer through a very unpolished talk. This, I never really talked about this in public. It's my kind of more of a side interest, but maybe you will learn something from the talk. Maybe I'll learn something from your questions. We'll see. So you also heard a quick introduction by Shia about fractons, so I'll be quick and also vague, in part because I don't understand what fractons are. So each time we have a phenomenology in a gap to gapless system, I'll be also, it's not about topology, the talk is not about topological order. Each time we have a situation in a gap to gapless system when you can create a particle that afterwards cannot move, and I'll explain, I'll give many examples how this can happen. Then we will say that the system supports fractons. So my definition of a fracton would be particle that cannot move, or quasi-particle. It will so happen that sometimes combinations of particles that cannot move will be able to move, but will be able to move under certain, in certain directions according to certain rules. So this talk is about deriving or providing a language to derive as general set of such rules as possible. So sometimes the rules are simple, meaning that if you have some combination of these fractons, they can move along lines or planes. Sometimes the rules are complicated. So we'll, if I speak quick enough, we'll get to this example when fractons can only hop by power of three lattice sites after applying certain operator that's supported on a version of a Sierpinski triangle. Now, there are two types of fracton phases. This language exists because we don't really understand what either one is. So I'll be again extremely vague. If there is something that can move, I'll say that we have a type one. Otherwise, I'll say that the fracton phase is type two. So the talk will also have two parts. The first part will be about type one, and the second part will be about type two. The ultimate goal of the talk is to develop a field theoretic approach that will allow us to talk about type two phases. So I heard from people in the audience, including some people in the audience, that that's impossible, and maybe it is, but that's the best that I could come up with so far. Well, at some point, references will appear. I won't bother to read them, but you can ask me during the talk. So again, she told you a few words about Hakoud. This is how this whole thing started, as far as I understand. There's also nice work by Yoshida. So I will not be able to tell you anything new about the Hakoud. Maybe the one thing that I would like to emphasize is that Hakoud is a very weird example when it satisfies what we would like to demand from a topologically ordered system as condensed matter theorists, but it has the property that the degeneracy depends on the system size, and this is also true for topologically ordered type 1 phases. And the fact that degeneracy depends on the system size says that if there is an IR theory, it will depend on the volume form, the volume of the manifold where the system resides. And that is in contradiction with what we would like to call topological quantum field theory. So it's a topologically ordered system, but it's not clear whether it can be implemented as a topological quantum field theory. Most likely cannot, because topological quantum field theory almost by definition does not depend on the volume form. Also, final disclaimer for the language, I will be extremely vague with my language. Each time, I will not distinguish gapped and gapless phases. There are gapped fracton phases that she was talking about. Those gapped phases will be obtained, sometimes can be obtained from the story that I'll tell you about by Higgsing the integer charge to a ZK charge. And again, if we make it to the end of the talk, I'll show examples of how to do that. Sometimes I will end up with gapped phases that are not topological. They're just symmetry protected by the symmetries I'll discuss. So I don't know why I wrote such a long outline. The first part will be about type one phases. I'll do my best to demystify them if you're not used to that. I'll try to give examples of theories that we have known for centuries that exhibit a similar phenomena. And the second part of the talk will be about type 2 phases, where I will briefly revisit type 1 phases from different angle and try to generalize the story from that angle. The main references are these two papers. So if everything goes well and I speak quick enough, we'll make it to U1 and Z2 hard code, starting from effective field theory. But well, I probably will not speak quick enough. And also feel free to interrupt me, of course. So let's start on something that we'll probably find a common ground on, no matter what your background is, which is particle vortex duality. This is an example of how U1 gauge field appears in condensed matter. So imagine we have a theory of superfluid described by a complex scalar. This has global U1 symmetry. Global U1 symmetry implies conservation of current. And if we choose to do so, we can study this theory in different variables. The variables introduced by solving this current conservation equation. So we can introduce a vector, a rho, such that it solves this conservation equation. And then we can rewrite the action in terms of this vector, a rho. What's non-trivial about this variable change is that current is an observable. So any change in A that does not change current should not lead to the physically distinct configurations. That's another way of saying it is that A rho is not just a vector, it's a gauge field, and two A rhos that differ by a gradient of a smooth function are physically equivalent, and therefore we would say that there is a gauge symmetry or gauge redundancy in the definition of A. So if we are to write this Lagrangian in terms of A, we would write something that's gauge invariant, for example, Maxwell theory. The trivial part about this map is that Lagrangian has a gauge symmetry. Gauge symmetry will imply Gauss law. And Gauss law has the defining property that if you actually calculate this divergence of electric field in terms of original variables, it maps to the curl of the current. And curl of the current is proportional to curl of the velocity, which is definition of vorticity. So the density that appears in the left-hand side or in this Gauss law is not density of the original charge, it's density that produces it's vorticity. So you can think of it as density of vortices. Now we're going to use this picture to arrive to our first type 1 models. So there is a generalization of this story to 3 plus 1, which leads to the tensor gauge field, but this tensor gauge field has to be antisymmetric. It's a two-form, it has one-form symmetry, and such theories couple to charges that are not fractons, but instead they are extended on lines or planes. So this is just generalizing this to high dimensions will not give us fractons. What will give us fractons is studying a slightly different equation. So imagine now that we have conservation of a charge whose density happens to be a vector density. So this most famous example of this is actually one of the first field theories ever discovered is a theory of continuous media, mechanics of continuous media. In that theory, the main conservation law is conservation of momentum. The propagating degrees of freedom are phonons. The number of those guys is not conserved, but the momentum is. So here's the conservation law. We would like to do the same thing we did before. When I talked about particle vortex duality, I would like to solve this conservation equation. So I'm going to write T, which is stress, which is a 2x3 matrix in 2 plus 1 dimensions that has momentum and stress in it. And it's resolved, this conservation law is resolved by this formula where AI rho is a vector valued one form. Or another way of saying it is the spatial part of this is a tensor, which is not antisymmetric. Our charge, if you wish, it's kind of like many components of superfluid, but not exactly, because the label here is not just an internal label, it's instead a spatial index. So this is what will produce all of the non-trivial features. Now, in components, this can be written as follows. The momentum is given by this combination of derivatives and this tensor. This tensor is, of course, a gauge field for the same reasons A rho was gauge field in the previous example. And this combination I'll call magnetic field, whereas this combination I'll call electric field. So this is just a direct repetition of the particle vortex duality for bosons. And this electric field is made of time derivative of this tensor and of gradient of its temporal component, which, since we don't have Lorentz symmetry, I will just denote as another vector.
Is this A symmetric or?
No, no. This A is a vector valued one form.
Okay.
So it's a 2x3 matrix. Its spatial part, the one that appears here, it's a spatial vector valued one form. It does not have to be symmetric, but what's not trivial is that it's not anti-symmetric. So it has symmetric and anti-symmetric parts. The gauge redundancy of such theory is a gradient of a vector, and written in components, it's gradient of a vector, and it's time derivative of this vector. The fact that stress tensor is symmetric implies that the electric field here has to be traceless. And similarly, we can write a Maxwell theory that has gauge symmetry, and gauge symmetry will imply a Gauss law of this form. Again, E here is not symmetric. So the density of vortices in this theory is a vector instead of a scalar. And this is not too shocking because in elasticity, the defects are, the low energy defects are dislocations which are characterized by a Burgers vector, well, which is a vector. So all of this structure is a bit different, again, from multiple copies of superfluid because this index I is spatial and not internal. I'd like to emphasize it throughout the discussion of type 1 phases. Okay. There is a particular solution to this equation where I can relax the gauge freedom a little bit. I'm going to say that the gauge parameter is itself a gradient of something. That's not always possible, but turns out that in elasticity it is possible. If gauge parameter is a gradient of something, then the gauge transformation for A looks like this, and A has to be a symmetric tensor now. The gauge parameter for temporal, so the temporal component of A itself also has to be a gradient. The transformation for the temporal component is just time derivative of this gauge parameter. The gauge, the Gauss law takes this form, and what we have really postulated is that there exists some density for which our vector charge is the dipole moment, or is the first moment. So this doesn't have to be true in general for, suppose I just handed you the structure, this doesn't have to be true. But for elasticity, it is true. That I can reduce the previous gauge structure to this one. So let's take this as a starting point. It's a dual description of a theory that has been studied for at least a century and see if there are any funny properties. And if you know something about elasticity, you should already expect the finite properties of this rho. So first of all, yes.
Maybe yeah. I got lost. So yeah. What's special about elasticity that reduces the gauge redundancy?
Well, I mean, this is the, that's what I'm going to be explaining for this next 10, 15 minutes. But I hope you will, this next 10 minutes will answer this question, maybe next 5 minutes. So the total charge, so imagine our theory now on a closed manifold, okay? Then I'm going to take the Gauss law and integrate it over the whole manifold. Well, if the manifold is closed, then this is total derivative and total charge of this rho. And recall that rho is describing defects, it's not describing phonons in any way. So the integral of this rho has to be zero on a closed manifold. But what's unusual is that the integral of the first moment of the density of the dipole moment of this manifold also has to be zero because it's also a total divergence. And this happens because this, this Gauss law has two derivatives. Yes.
In this case, even on open boundary, with open boundary, Q is also zero? Or?
Well, with open boundary, that's a boundary term. So when, with open boundary, this formula just tells you that if you have electric charge, then you can see that it creates electric field.
But now your last equation there is derivative of E integrated over the boundary. Mm-hmm. Then this becomes the boundary of the boundary.
This Sure, sure. In this case, fine. This is identically zero, but in this case, let me just assume to avoid any kind of ambiguity that M is closed.
I'm just asking about Q, not about D.
Okay.
So for Q, even if you have open boundary, it's zero.
Sure. Yeah. Integral of derivative bound. Yeah. So boundary is closed. Integral of derivative. Sure. Now, if you do the same exercise with dipole moment and Maxwell theory, you would find that dipole moment equals to the integral of electric field throughout the closed manifold. So it turns out that this constraint that the dipole moment on a closed manifold has to be zero has a curious property, has a curious consequence that was pointed out by Michael Pretka. That suppose you did create one of these charges such that, you know, on the total manifold, total charge is zero, total dipole is zero, but somehow you manage to isolate one of those charges. Then a single charge cannot hop, because the second it hops, it changes dipole moment. Its x changes. So the conservation of, or rather restriction of the dipole moment prevents the free motion of an isolated charge. It turns out that in elasticity, there is another constraint that says that the trace of the quadrupole moment of this defect is related to the density of vacancies. I will, turn this statement in the pictures in a second, but for now, just believe me that that's true. It also has been known for at least 50, 60 years in elasticity, and this constraint saying that the right-hand side is a constant prohibits the motion of this kind. So conservation of dipole does not prohibit to move the dipoles, but conservation of trace of quadrupole tensor or quadrupole moment prohibits this motion while allows this motion. So in this particular example, dipoles can only move perpendicular to their dipole moment. So let's just play with it a little bit. Hopefully it will be clear later on in the talk why I want to play this game. Imagine you have created one of these charges. Let's try to move it. Well, we cannot just move it because we'll change dipole moment. What we can do is we can pull out a quadrupole out of vacuum because that doesn't violate any constraint. And I can take this quadrupole and align it with this charge. I'll get something like this. So now my charge has hopped, but it emitted a dipole. I can pull another quadrupole out of vacuum, bring it, move this dipole away, and so on. I can keep hopping this charge by bringing more quadrupoles out of vacuum as well, and move it this away. So what you're supposed to learn from this picture is that if I do have a single isolated charge, I still can hop it, but each time I hop it, I will leave something behind. So if I am to move it by some macroscopic distance, somewhere else in the system, there will be a memory about this motion. And this memory will be in some macroscopic dipole moment. So if this dipole moment costs some macroscopic amount of energy, then of course such process would be prohibited energetically, or energetically unfavorable, let's say. Okay. Now, I told you about elasticity on a very obscure language. And elasticity has been studied to death. Its study predates Cartan geometry. So there's no way in the universe I'm telling you anything new. And of course, I am not. In elasticity, all of this is understood very well. And in elasticity, there are three types of defects. Let's just briefly discuss them to make sure that I'm not telling you some sci-fi story that has nothing to do with reality. So the first type of defects in elasticity is called vacancy, which is when you take one of the latest sites and erase it. I'm giving an example of 2D elasticity. A second example of a defect in elasticity is called dislocation, when you take a line of atoms and erase it. And if you create such a defect and you make an attempt to go around it, you end up translated by a vector. This vector is called Burgers vector. So dislocations are characterized by a Burgers vector. And this Burgers vector has a property that if you have created a dislocation like this, then dislocation cannot move in the direction perpendicular to the Burgers vector, provided that the total number of lattice sites is not allowed to change. So to see this, this phenomenon is called glide constraint, and it's important in how actual materials deform under strain. So if you imagine creating a dislocation and trying to move it along Burgers vector, all you have to do is rearrange some lattice sites and you end up with a dislocation that's translated. However, if you create a dislocation and make an attempt to move it perpendicular to its Burgers vector, and that's true in any dimension, then you find that you have to start erasing lattice sites. So if you impose the conservation of lattice sites, so to say, or if you just fix the number of lattice sites, which is true at low temperatures in elasticity theory, then this motion is prohibited. So dislocation is a particle that can only move along its Burgers vector, or it's rather a defect that can only move along its Burgers vector. Of course, in real material at finite temperature, such movement is possible when there is a thermal fluctuation that creates vacancies, but it's much harder to move to climb than to glide. Well, so I mentioned that the partially mobile particles are often dipoles of something. Okay, so you can ask a question, is there a way within elasticity to imagine that the dislocation is a dipole of something? Turns out that there is. There is another defect that's much more high energy than dislocation. It's called disclination. And you can imagine it by taking your original lattice. So this is example I stole from Bickman et al. You can imagine taking your original square lattice, kind of opening it and shoving another wedge of material that's macroscopically big. That's called Volterra construction of disclinations. So here, material is added, and you see that this point in the lattice has five lines connecting to it instead of four. That's the characteristic of disclinations. It so happens, and this I will not explain in detail, but I can explain to you privately, that if you make an attempt to move a disclination, then you will end up creating dislocations along the way. And one way to summarize it is that the current of that if you have a current of disclinations, so the state is a current of disclinations, so disclinations are flowing some way, then this current automatically violates the conservation of the current of dislocations. So this is a relation you can derive within elasticity. This relation can also be viewed as a Bianchi identity of the geometric approach to elasticity, which is the content of my, yeah.
How should I interpret this figure, I mean, in terms of the original fractal model and lattice?
Well, this is just inserting a fracton,
so
just creating it. This is like in elasticity doing, it's like messing with the lattice in the elasticity.
So am I changing the lattice geometry?
So on the fracton language, you just create excitation on your original lattice.
It has an effect.
But in elasticity, you really mess with the lattice.
Okay.
So this is why I find this fracton story extremely appealing, because it allows you to talk about distortions of a medium on a fixed medium. This is, if that sentence makes sense to anyone, that I find, on the fracton language, you fix the lattice and create excitations, whereas on elastic language, you mess with the lattice. You distort the lattice, you create, so I'm not sure if all of you know this, but there is a way to think about elasticity in terms of Riemann-Cartan geometry. So these defects create curvature, and dislocation defects create torsion. So you can model torsion and curvature by simply creating excitations on a fixed lattice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in the elasticity story, is the lattice, I assume the lattice translation is important?
Of course, yeah.
But the rotation is not, or?
Well, rotation is discrete. But if you go to continuum, then effective theory for phonons is rotational invariant.
Sure, but is that symmetry important for any of this to be well defined?
That's a really good question. And the second part of the talk is exactly about breaking rotational symmetry. Okay. So for this story to have type one model, so to say, it is important.
It is.
Okay. But later on, I will violate rotational symmetry, and this is what leads to type 2 models.
But translation, discrete translation is always important.
Discrete translations are important, yes. But again, in continuum, there are continuous translations.
Yeah. So you said that these locations can move only in a particular direction, right?
Dislocations, yes. Right.
What about with disclinations?
Cannot move at all.
Then when you say if you move a disclination, you leave dislocation behind.
Yeah, well, this is like a virtual process. So imagine that creating a single dislocation costs a lot of energy. Then you cannot move disclination. So all of this is up to, you know, creating particles that cost finite energy. So when I told you about fracton hopping emitting dipoles, right, this is energy costly process which creates microscopic dipole. When I draw this picture, I talk about kinematics, but on the back of your head, you also should think about dynamics, that some of this process will cost a lot of energy, some won't. So energetically, this cannot move, because you will have to create macroscopic amount of dislocations. And in fracton language, that means that if you want to move a fracton, you will create a huge dipole moment elsewhere. So there's a direct map between any statement in either theory. So a historic quick comment. As elasticity was studied for ages indeed, and some people knew about dualities who studied elasticity. So here's an example of a paper where the symmetric tensor gauge theories were introduced in 1983 by Kleinert. Also Jan Zanen likes this language, but I couldn't find any reference. And in this particular paper, he even says it is useful to introduce symmetric tensor gauge fields. So I would attribute this story to at least early 1980s. Okay, so this is the story of elasticity. If you were supposed to learn anything from this part, is that the tensor gauge theories at least exist as a dual description of some theory that definitely is well understood. Now, as a next step, I suggest to kind of relax and leave physics behind for a bit, and just take it as a fact that such theories exist, meaning theories of tensors. And let's write another theory and just have fun with it. So here is another theory which is not dual to elasticity in three dimensions. It has the Gauss law, just like the one that I showed to you before, but before it was in two dimensions. In three dimensions, elastic defects are lines, so you would have to have combination of the symmetric tensor story and forms. But here I'm going to imagine point charges in three dimensions whose charge density is a vector. And this Gauss law follows from such a gauge symmetry. And some of you may recognize this gauge symmetry as transformation that metric obeys if you linearize metric close to flat background. Now, the magnetic field that for which this is invariant, for which that gauge symmetry is invariant, that leaves this, oh my god, 2x2, 3x3 matrix that's invariant under this can be constructed by contracting enough epsilon tensors, derivatives, and A's. You may recognize linearized Ricci tensor in this formula. And such theory has a non-trivial constraint that if you form this combination of the vector charge x and epsilon, so if you take vector product of x with rho, you find that if you have created charge whose little charge vector points in direction rho k, then this charge can only move in the direction perpendicular to this rho k, so it's a two-dimensional particle. And theories like this were studied by Sankey and by Sankey with Peter Hajava early in 2000s on the lattice. So there is something, we're about to wrap up type one phases, but let me just quickly make this comment. There is something funny about these phases. Their charges are vectors. And if you have a charge that's a vector, then depending on kind of your background, you may immediately see a problem that if you make an attempt to put this theory in a curved space or space-time, then, well, space-time is out of question immediately because the theory is not Lorentz invariant, but space may still be appealing. And if you make an attempt to put this theory in curved space, then there is a problem. The problem is that if you imagine this cone modeling a curved space and you have this vector charge, then if you move this charge in a closed loop that encloses a region of non-zero curvature, then this charge comes back to itself rotated just by the laws of Riemannian geometry. So it doesn't mean that these theories are sick or anything, but that's a peculiar property of them. They really don't like to be put in curved space. And this can be the same thing can be said formally. In two dimensions, it's particularly simple. Let's take symmetric tensor theory. That's the magnetic field. That's the transformation of the vector potential, of the symmetric tensor vector potential under this gauge symmetry. And if I am to put it in curve space, I have to replace all derivatives by covariant derivatives. And the way gauge symmetry works in flat space is that this derivative commutes with this one. And because of this epsilon, magnetic field is gauge invariant. But in curve space, this covariant derivative does not commute with this covariant derivative. So a magnetic field is not gauge invariant. Its violation of gauge invariance is proportional, roughly speaking, to the Ricci tensor. And in higher dimensions, to Riemann tensor. And there are some compromises that one can make. So for example, in three dimensions, particular theory, which is a 3D traceless scalar charge theory, can be defined on Einstein manifold, but cannot be defined on any other manifold. So a relationship with curved space is very interesting for these phases. One consequence of this is that it's very difficult to define a stress tensor, because if you would like to make to use our favorite trick to calculate stress tensor, which is Pootz theorem in curved space, make variation over the metric, and this won't work here, because theory doesn't want to be on curved space. Okay, so this is my short summary of type 1 phases. Are there any questions at this point? We're going to go into some crazy stuff right now.
Yes? Half space, you mean like in a platform, you know, like this language, you first create some excitation, then create the color space, and then on top of that, you are studying.
So on the lightest language, you would want to take the lattice where fractons live, not the elastic one,
right,
and insert crystalline defects into that lattice.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Kevin and I guess Young Bayek studied that, and they find that there are extra degrees or extra states start appearing on these regions of non-trivial curvature. Yeah. Okay. So to get to type 2 phases, we have to very briefly revisit type 1 phases. Sorry. There's many different ways to think about type 1 phases. So one way to get to gauge theory is to find a global symmetry and gauge it. So the global symmetry we're interested in is a global symmetry that leads to the conservation of a dipole or higher multiple moments of a conserved charge. So imagine you have a, let's say, real scalar that describes a phase of a superfluid or something. Then symmetry like this, ordinary shift symmetry, leads to conservation of charge. I'm going to demand that there is an additional global symmetry. I put global in brackets. Because the global symmetry is shift of theta by a linear polynomial of the coordinates. So in two dimensions, this is lambda 1 x1 plus lambda 2 x2. In three dimensions, the same plus lambda 3 x3. So if you demand such symmetry, so it's, I call it global because lambda is a parameter that doesn't depend on the space or time. So if you take symmetry like this and apply Noether's theorem to it, then you find that the first moment of the charge density is conserved. Now, what kind of theory has this symmetry? Well, it's not too difficult to guess a theory. If you want to kill this, if you want to accomplish this symmetry, you need to supplement theta with one derivative. If you want to accomplish this symmetry, you have to supplement theta with two derivatives. So you get a theory like this, which also has been studied for quite a while. I think originally a version of this appeared in the work by Lifshitz. And recently, these symmetries have been revisited by Berkeley people, although their motivation is completely different. So we are going to obtain the type 1 phases again, type 1 fracton phases again, by taking the symmetry, engaging it, and getting gauge fields. Well, this is the invariant derivative I had before. Now I'm going to declare that theta depends on space and time. And to ensure that now my new theory is invariant under this local transformation, I have to introduce a gauge field, just like I do in ordinary charged fermion story. But now, this gauge field has to transform by di dj of the C. So it's clear that this combination, when theta transforms like this and they transform like this, is invariant. under this local transformation. So we end up with Lagrangian of this kind. Lagrangian has electric field, magnetic field that we have seen before, but from different perspective. And there is a Gauss law. Gauss law implies all the same constraints for the charges. So the reason I went into this is that it turns out that it is this point of view that provides us with an opportunity for generalization. To get to this opportunity, let me just finally mention one last subtlety about the symmetry is that it clearly does not commute with spatial translations. If I translate x by r by some vector r, then and apply a commutator of this polynomial shift symmetry with the translation, then I get a gauge transformation. This is a bit unusual because usually we prefer internal symmetries to be separated from spatial ones. Yes, in spin liquid you can have some variations on the story, but in field theory you usually have spatial symmetries as separate and internal symmetries separate. Here we don't have such opportunity. Here, if we want conservation of dipole, we have to enlarge group of spatial symmetries. If we want conservation of quadrupole, we have to enlarge it even further. So here is a very instructive example that leads to that corresponds to a theory that's exactly dual to elasticity, which is we want to accomplish that dipoles. Suppose we want to accomplish the dipoles move only perpendicular to the dipole moment. Then the global symmetry that we demand is going to be going to look like this. We have a shift of theta by a number times absolute value of x squared. So it's x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared in three dimensions. If I demand this symmetry, it turns out that the trace of quadrupole tensor is also conserved. But now writing the invariant derivative is a bit more complicated. Because clearly anything that has three derivatives will work, but turns out that any derivative that has two derivatives and contracted with a traceless tensor will also work. So this example may get you thinking about the generalization. Let's not just shift by all linear polynomials. Let's just take some of our favorite polynomials, chosen, let's say, arbitrary or by some other principles of beauty or something like this, and demand that theta is invariant under shifts by numbers times the polynomials of your choice. If you demand such global symmetry, then the conserved charges are going to be these polynomials integrated against rho. If I demand that these polynomials are homogeneous, then these are going to be particular components of the multiple tensors. So we can demand conservation of dipole in x direction, and then Q1, conservation of xy component of quadrupole tensor, and then something else. However, if you pick these things at random, you will end up with a problem. If you pick these things at random, you will find that these polynomials at random, you will find that the polynomials will contradict translational and rotational symmetries. So if I picked, so in order to preserve at least translational symmetries, I have to demand that a polynomial, when it's translated, so this is what commutator of translation and this polynomial symmetry is proportional to, that this difference of polynomial at translated position and polynomial or not translated position is a linear superposition of polynomials of 1 degree lower. Okay? In this case, the translation symmetry is consistent with the choice of polynomials. Otherwise, it's not. Alternatively, you can view this equation as equation for R. For some translations, our choice of polynomial is consistent, whereas for others, it's not. Similarly with rotations. So rotations do not change degree of the polynomial. But if we want to preserve all rotations, I have to demand that polynomial at rotated position has to be linear superposition of the original polynomials. So to get type 2 phases, I will end up violating this, sorry, keeping translations, but violating some rotations. What I'm doing less formally is that in ENM, you usually learn that the higher moments are well defined if all lower moments are zero. Okay? Turns out that you can compromise a little bit more when you talk about multiple moments. Imagine this example. This example is essentially hard-coded. Imagine that you have a dipole moment that looks in z direction. Okay? Then turns out that the quadrupole moment with components xx, xy, and yy is still invariant under translations. This is simply follows from the transformation law of the quadrupole moment under translation. The reason xx, xy, and yy components don't transform is that this d has zero x and zero y components, but non-zero z components. However, in such situation, we lost rotations that rotate x and y into the z direction. But rotations in the xy plane are still preserved. So we are going to choose the conservation laws that kind of like this in flavor. We're going to demand that some components of dipole moment are conserved, and then demand conservation of components of quadrupole moment that are consistent with the conservation of the dipole moment. So here's an example that exhibits everything about type 2 phases except topological order. So this is a very simple 2D example. I don't know if Benny had something like this in his paper. I didn't manage to translate completely, but maybe you can tell me if you had something like this. So consider a system where a dipole moment in 1 minus 1 direction is conserved, and this combination of components of quadrupole moment is also conserved. Well, these two conservation laws imply that the charge configurations that we allow to create must carry dipole in the 1-1 direction, direction perpendicular to this, to the conservation direction. So if you have some macroscopic dipole moment in the system that's proportional to 1-1, which is the component of the dipole moment that's not conserved, then it's a simple arithmetic check that this linear combination of quadrupoles does not transform under translation. So I can independently demand this conservation. And this is what I'm going to do. If you demand these two conservation laws, then the only combination of particles that you can create looks like this. It's 1 minus 2, 1. And since you can create this combination, you can hop it. So this is the only mobile, fully mobile excitation, but that's a trivial one. Now, it's easy to write a field theory, but maybe I should skip it, except that I can specify the polynomial symmetry. The polynomials in question in two dimensions are x minus y and x minus y squared. I just need like a minute or two. So this symmetry can be gauged, but what I want to do is I want to play with pictures a little bit. So imagine, let's try to study how this, if there are some restricted mobility phenomena in this game. So I have created this combination, 1 minus 2, 1, and the only way I can try to move either one of these guys is by creating a copy of the same combination, maybe multiplied by an integer. So let me do exactly that. I'm going to create this combination to kill this charge and that charge, and then I end up with a few more charges, but one row lower. Then I can do the same thing one more time, the same thing one more time. So what I can do in this theory is I can separate this charge from other ones, but when I do this, each charge that I create is going to be exponentially big in the separation. So there are no partially mobile particles, but there is this very strange phenomenon. So let me call this type 2 behavior, but for the U1 phases. This I can tell you later. So let's just do the final example, which is, imagine we take the same theory, but now condense charge 3 objects. So I have like Cooper triples, if you wish. Then a charge is defined mod 3 instead of being an integer, and I can convert this minus 2 into 1. Then there are only two fundamental configurations of charges, 1-1-1 and 2-2-2. 3-3-3 is equivalent to vacuum, and anything else violates the conservation laws. So I can ask a question. Suppose I created something like this here. Can I hop these two guys? And the answer is you can, but only on lattices that are 3 to the power k times 3 to the power k size. The reason it works like this is that if you want to hop this guy over here, you need to apply operators, this yellow and green stars, in this fashion. You create it here, then you apply green stars here, then yellow stars here. Only by doing this, you can hop this particle two spots to the right. Turns out that if you increase the lattice by one or by two or by three or by four, you cannot hop them further. But if you go to the lattice that's 3 squared by 3 squared, you can create a new structure, new sequence of this yellow and green stars that will hop this particle all the way to the end. And this is drawing this is where I ran out of patience, but I stole this picture from Benny's paper. If you now look at 27 by 27 lattice, you again can hop the particles. And here he has different color scheme, but the structure that you will see looks like this. There are these bigger structures and there are smaller ones. And the next lattice would be 3 to the 4 by 3 to the 4. So here you have non-local operators, kind of like Wilson lines, but these operators are supported on this strange structure. It's a version of the Sierpinski triangle. This, in two dimensions, the system is gapped, but it's not topologically ordered. But well, it's still interesting to play with it. Okay, so it's completely obvious that Harcourt is made from using this symmetry. And if it's not obvious to you, then I just wasted my time. So it's Lagrangian for matter looks like this, derivatives look like that, conservation. Maybe this is the last thing I say, and then you can kick me out. So when you actually demand the things that make Harcourt Harcourt, you end up with a whole zoo of symmetries. And I don't understand why, but this seems to be the case. So Harcourt has this dipole conservation loss, quadrupole conservation loss. It's translationally invariant in all directions. It has rotational symmetry in the plane spanned by these two vectors. These are the vectors in which these are directions in which dipole moment is conserved. However, let me not call this yet Harcourt, but the theory that gives you the Harcourt also is critical, it seems. And the scaling symmetry in this theory is very unusual. It's not Lifshitz, it's some double Lifshitz, I don't know how to call this. The space and time scale differently, but also different space directions scale differently. Moreover, it has infinite symmetry. If you change theta by holomorphic function of x plus iy, where x plus I, x and y are these directions, not x1 and x2, or by any anti-holomorphic function of x plus iy, then this is a symmetry for arbitrary f and g. So this theory has infinite number of conservation laws. So this theory is kind of looks like a stack of two-dimensional theories in the direction perpendicular to the 1-1-1 direction. And it is in 1-1-1 direction you have the non-conservation of dipole. By doing this, playing this game, you find charge configurations, and by condensing charge two objects, you find these two configurations. From those, you can construct the fractals that appear in the Haar story. But I don't know how to prove using this language that it's topologically ordered. So, sorry for taking more time. Thank you.
So in this field theory way of writing Haar's code, like the U1 version of Haar's code, does it depend on how you regularize a field theory or it's independent regularization on lattice?
This is not a quick question. So it's almost as a consequence of this symmetry, it may become immediately clear that this symmetry implies that some of your coupling constants are necessarily going to be dimension of length, okay? Which means that one of the two possibilities are realized. Either it significantly depends on the cutoff, or there is an emerging length scale. I prefer to think of this as a version of a smectic that formed in the 1-1-1 direction. The emerging length scale is just periodicity of this smectic. Having said that, there is another subtlety, but this one I would rather discuss in private, which has to do with demanding that the dipole moment which has to do with choosing this d0 that I had. With choosing this d0 over there. This d0, if it's integer, then you end up with configurations like this, and three-hard code is just three-dimensional version of this. But if I allow this d0 to be square root of 2, let's say, let's integer multiple of square root of 2, then instead, 1-1 dipoles are not like this, but they look like that. And the dynamics is completely different. So there is an extra choice, extra quantization choice, kind of like choosing compactification radius, but for dipoles, that makes dramatic difference. So this is the most non-trivial dependence on the lattice.
Thanks, speaker.